caught with class, and this program invites high school students from around the state to join us for an oral argument. If the class accepts, then we send materials about the case, and the class may invite lawyers or others to discuss the case with them. And then the last part of the session is to meet with a justice at noon. And everyone is invited to come to that noon session, if you like. So we've met our friends from Wisconsin Rapids Lincoln High School, and now I'd like to introduce the court to you all. On my far left is Justice Diane Sykes, and she is the justice with whom you all will meet at noon today. Seated next to her is Justice Patrick Crooks. To my immediate left is Justice John Wilcox. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice William Babich, and to his right, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and on the far right, Justice David Prosser. With these introductions made, I'll call the first case, which is Joseph Finnegan versus the Wisconsin Patients Compensation Fund. I have scheduled here that Randall Arnold, representing Aurora Medical Group, will argue first for 13 minutes, and George Burnett, representing the Wisconsin Patients Compensation Fund, 12 minutes. We'll then have 30 minutes by Mr. Aiken and 5 minutes of rebuttal by Mr. Arnold. Council agree? Then we shall proceed. Mr. Arnold.
Thank you and good morning. May it please the court, council, guests. In any case before this court, it is probably true that achieving a proper outcome depends on how the issue is formulated, how the court views what the problem is to be solved. I think that's especially true in this case. So at the outset, I would like to urge the court to view the problem to be solved in this case, and to view the issue that this case is about, is the somewhat narrow topic of what are referred to as bystander claims for negligent infliction of emotional distress, and not the broader topic of negligent infliction of emotional distress claims as a whole, or the broader topic of third-party claims against healthcare providers as a whole. This case involves, starting from that point, the intersection between two streams of the law. One, the common law, dealing with the question of when and how we compensate people who have been affected by their experience of the suffering or death of a family member or loved one, and how we interpret Chapter 655, which limits the liability of healthcare providers. The issue of how to deal with people's experience of the suffering or death of their family members occupied this court for the better part of the last century, starting in 1925. I'd like to suggest that the reason for that is that the issue involves a fundamental paradox of human experience about suffering and death of others. That is, viewed from the abstract, there is nothing less extraordinary than suffering and death. Nothing less to be characterized as unique. Suffering and death are indeed universal and to be experienced by all of us, not only personally, but to witness the suffering and death of those we love. The paradox is that while that experience is so universal as to hardly require our attention when we talk about it in global terms, when we get down to the experience of dealing with our own personal loss, it's perceived by us as extraordinary. So the court deals with the question of how do we separate the issue of the general experience of suffering and death of others, which we all must face at one time or another, and the extraordinary personal toll that that takes on us when it happens in our family or to our loved ones. There is a theme that runs throughout all of the decisions by this court on that topic. From the beginning through the Bowen case, which is that the experience of the suffering and death of a loved one is by itself not to be compensated. It's not the subject of a claim. The court recognizes from the outset in Walby and through Bowen that the suffering and death of our loved ones are universal experiences for which we cannot expect to be compensated. What the court tries to do through a series of steps of development of the common law is carve out a method for identifying those specific types of experience of the loss of loss relating to the suffering and death of our loved ones for which compensation can be obtained through the courts. After struggling with a number of formulas, the last stop in the development is the Bowen case, which begins its analysis by recognizing once again that it's not the suffering and death of the loved one for which we're compensated, but the sensory experience of perceiving that suffering or death under extraordinary circumstances. The court in Bowen said that the tort of negligence infliction of emotional distress compensates plaintiffs whose natural shock and grief upon the death or severe physical injury of a spouse, parent, child, etc., are compounded by the circumstances under which they learn of the serious injury or death. In other words, it is not the suffering related to the loss, but that suffering, which is universal, compounded by the circumstances under which that suffering is perceived by the plaintiff.
I suppose, counsel, instead here of the child dying in the parent's arms, you had a situation where they are in the doctor's office and the doctor does make some terrible error, and then they see the child with blood spurting. Would that be a different case under your what I thought was an excellent introduction to the philosophical and legal issues here?
I believe that it would, but for the impact of Chapter 655.
Okay, well, let's just leave that aside for the moment.
I agree with you that immediate perception in the doctor's office of blood spurting from a wound caused by medical negligence, for example, would appear to fit the Bowen definition of an extraordinary event, provided that the other criteria are met. the relationship between the claimant and the victim of the event and the serious physical injury or death, then I believe that yes, the immediate perception of an obvious physical injury flowing from the conduct of the physician would meet the phase three of the Bowen test.
Well, in Bowen, they didn't actually see the car accident. They came upon it moments later. So why isn't this moments later?
The way the court characterizes that issue in Bowen is that it is the direct perception of the injury-producing event, either witnessing it or in the immediate, what the court refers to on a couple of occasions as the gruesome aftermath. From that, I believe it's reasonable to infer that the court is suggesting that it is possible to come upon the event so soon after its occurrence that it's the substantial equivalent of having been there. The court, for example, in Bowen very clearly draws the distinction between coming upon the accident scene in Bowen and seeing the child in the tangled wreckage of the car and perhaps having come a few minutes later or 15 minutes later and witnessing the child in the ambulance or seeing the child being treated in the hospital. The court clearly says in Bowen that perception of the efforts to treat the injury isn't compensated. So I believe that one can say that immediate aftermath is a very important component of step three of the Bowen criteria. And it's one of the problems presented in the medical malpractice context, because obviously, in many instances, the time delay between an alleged act of medical negligence and the resulting harm to the patient may take years. A physician may misread an x-ray, and there's no observable injury of any kind that flows from that event until 4 or 5 years later when the patient is diagnosed with a metastatic cancer. It's true that in an abstract sense, in the way that the law talks about an injury, that failure to diagnose produces an injury. But in the sense that Bowen talks about an injury, coming upon a traumatic event, either witnessing it or witnessing the immediate aftermath, so it's almost as though you were there, that set of circumstances is not going to exist in the vast majority of medical malpractice cases where an emotional distress claim might be asserted.
Are you positing that Mr. Aiken's position is that, if he should prevail, that in essence every medical malpractice action will result in a claim for emotional distress?
I don't have any data that I can supply the court, but I've been defending medical malpractice cases for many years, and I can certainly represent to the court that the vast majority of those cases involve not only a claim by the primary victim, the patient, but by a family member, spouse, child, or more than one of the claimants in that category. I see very little reason to think that if Mr. Aiken's position were adopted by the court, that asserting a negligent infliction of emotional distress claim by a derivative claimant would be made in almost every case where the claimant has had relative has had the opportunity to observe the alleged victim of malpractice in suffering or dying as a result of the disease.
Are you saying that that is the present practice out there, that there is a claim for negligent infliction of emotional distress by a relative?
No, I am saying that I would certainly say at least half and probably the majority of cases, a claim is brought by a family member in addition to the primary claim for loss of society and companionship. And there's no reason to expect that if the court were to adopt Mr. Aiken's position, that attached to that claim would also be a claim for negligent infliction of emotional distress, provided that the family member has had the opportunity to observe the primary claimant suffering the results of the alleged malpractice.
I think what you're, to follow up on Justice Babbitt's question, what are you saying, that if the court would go with opposing counsel's position, that we would see a lot of these claims?
I see no reason to think otherwise, simply because we know that the assertion of loss of society and companionship claims in medical negligence cases is routine. I see no reason to think that if we also allowed a claim not only for the loss of society and companionship caused by the alleged negligence, we wouldn't also see a claim for the emotional harm attendant to witnessing the primary claimant's suffering. I do think that this is one of those circumstances where the prong two of the concerns articulated by the court in the line of cases about bystander claims is paramount. That is, that there is no logical stopping point for this type of claim. Under Mr. Aiken, under the scenario related in Mr. Aiken's brief, a claim is asserted for example, for observing the death of the child, holding the child in their arms while the child died at the hospital. As tragic and traumatic as that must have been, it is also true that the plaintiffs undertook to have that experience. That's not that they involuntarily happened on an accident scene and were shocked to discover a tragic event. They knew that their child was in the hospital. They knew that their child might die. And they, understandably and for the most laudable reasons, agreed to participate and be present and comfort their child and be with their child when the child died. It's certainly something that medicine has encouraged more certainly in my lifetime. We have fathers in delivery rooms, and we are encouraging family members to be witnesses to and to participate in the health care of their family members. If this type of claim is allowed, I see a conflict between that type of public policy and the policy that encourages patients' families to be participants in their care. I think it's reasonable to speculate, at least, that adoption of this type of claim could result in hospitals curtailing the access of patients' family members to the patients, if by doing so they are permitting a class of potential claimants to enhance their injury claim.
Counsel, your time is up.
Thank you.
You have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Burnett.
May it please the court, I'm George Burnett, and I represent the Wisconsin Patients Compensation Fund. There has been much discussion in this case through the briefs about the common law and the effects of the Bowen decision. I have 3 points to make in the very short time I have, and the first is that this is not a case about the common law. This is a case about a statute passed by our legislature, 655.007. And in that statute, the legislature used one key word that I think is very important for the resolution of this case, and that word is derivative. It said that a patient can make a claim for the acts of malpractice, and it said any spouse, parent, minor, sibling, or child of the patient having a derivative claim for injury or death on account of malpractice is subject to the chapter as well. When the legislature selected the word derivative, I expect it had something in mind. And what it had in mind is that some claims by close relatives are actionable under Chapter 655, and other claims by close relatives are not. Yet as we read the opposing briefs in this case, we hear that claims for the loss of society and companionship and medical expenses are derivative and therefore actionable, and I agree with that. We hear that claims for injuries to other people in the Schuster versus Altenburg setting are derivative because they arise out of an act of malpractice and therefore actionable. We hear now that claims for negligent infliction of emotional distress are derivative and therefore actionable. So the question that one must logically ask is, what is left? Is there any claim that a close relative cannot make under Chapter 655? If the construction of the statute is to mean anything, there must be a different meaning to the word derivative than the one proffered by the plaintiffs. The proposal that we've advanced is that the word derivative means not arising from an act of malpractice, but it means one that depends on the plaintiff's right to bring a claim. A loss of society companionship is a loss for the relationship with the patient. That depends on the patient's right to bring a malpractice claim. A claim for medical expenses is a claim that depends on the plaintiff's right to bring the patient's right to bring the claim. That is derivative. Otherwise, any contrary construction would eliminate the word derivative from the statute that the legislature selected. The second point that I'd make is a point that this court has made many, many times before, and that is that Chapter 655 is much like Chapter 102, the Wisconsin Workers' Compensation Act, and it is a carefully balanced legislative scheme to control acts of malpractice. So we see in this court's decisions that sometimes Chapter 655 is far more restrictive than the common law on a patient's right to bring a claim. There are a limit on damage caps, for example. But on the other hand, we see sometimes that Chapter 655 is more expansive. The Jelinek decision that this court had several years ago, where a young mother fell to her death from a hospital window in a psychiatric ward, leaving four children and a surviving spouse. In Jelinek, this court, construing this very same statute that we are here today on, 655-007, said that statute allowed the mother, the father, the surviving spouse, and each of the four children a separate and independent claim for society and companionship. Whereas under the common law, that family would have shared $50,000. Under Chapter 655, that family recovered five society and companionship caps, each of $50,000. The important point is that when the legislature put this law together, it had a carefully balanced scheme in mind, and the request to this court in this case is to upset that scheme. The third point is perhaps the most troubling part of this case, and that's the point that is raised in the amicus briefs. In the amicus brief, this court is asked to declare essentially that there is another solar system of medical malpractice claims, one that still exists under the common law. The court has pointed to its decisions in Johnson versus Rogers Park, Schuster versus Altenburg, and Sawyer versus Middleford. and suggest, and it is suggested that the court has created such a common law claim. The short response to the amicus brief is 3 points. First of all, Chapter 655 mentions nothing about another common law claim for medical malpractice. As this court has said in Jelinek, Rinnick, Northwest General versus Yee, Patients Compensation Fund versus Lutheran Hospital, and most recently in the Sapansky case, Chapter 655 is the exclusive procedure under which one must bring a medical malpractice claim. The second point I would make is in Johnson, or strike that, in Schuster and Sawyer, there was no discussion at all of this issue of standing, who may bring a claim under Chapter 655, 007, and who may not. In Johnson and Sawyer, this court engaged in the traditional public policy analysis for general tort actions. In Johnson, the court construed a claim for breach of contract as one for professional negligence, and then said in a paragraph that because such claims were allowed in Sawyer, they must exist in Johnson as well. Johnson and Sawyer were both repressed memory cases. The important point is this. The second point is this. Johnson, Sawyer, and Schuster cannot be reconciled with Sapansky, where this court held that an adult child could bring no claim for medical malpractice for the death of a parent. And the reason that the court gave is in paragraph 2 of its decision. The court said, first, we hold that the language of 893.554F makes applicable to medical malpractice cases only the limit on damages and does not incorporate the wrongful death classification of claimants entitled to bring such an action. And then the court went on to say, quote, the classification of claimants entitled to bring a wrongful death suit for medical malpractice is limited to those enumerated in 655.007. What the court said in Sapansky is that 655.007 is a grant of standing. It is a grant of the right to bring a claim for medical malpractice. And if a claimant is not in there, or if a claimant's claim is not in there, they may not bring it. The last point that I would make on this issue is simply this, that the whole notion of there being yet a common law claim for medical malpractice is one fraught with serious policy considerations, especially when you consider that the primary focus, the primary duty that a physician has is to his patient, not to collateral claimants like those in Schuster and Sawyer. So while the patient is limited to $350,000 plus inflation for non-economic damages at common law, a collateral claimant would be unlimited. While the patient must proceed through a mediation process in order for the court to obtain jurisdiction, a collateral claimant could proceed immediately to suit. The collateral source rule does not apply to the patient's claim, but it would to a collateral claimant's. Does the physician who is sued in common law have coverage under the Wisconsin Patients Compensation Fund's obligations? Are these collateral common law claims, as they're proposed, governed by the same statute of limitations as one would be governed under general medical malpractice?
Mr. Burnett, in Chapter 655, we're referred to 893.55. Don't we have to look at those sections as well?
I think the general rule is always that a statute should be construed as a whole rather than singly. And that is a centerpiece of the plaintiff's case here, 893.55. The 893.55 specifically subparagraph 5, deals with limitations on damages. And it says in this subsection, referring just to that section, non-economic damages mean this: pain, suffering, emotional distress, many of the types of damages the plaintiffs claim here. But if you look at the balance of that very statute, 893.55, one sees the limitation on damages, the incorporation of contributory negligence rules into the statute, the elimination of the collateral source rule, and several other points. In a broad context, that statute is a procedural statute. It is only logical that the subsection of the statute that the plaintiffs rely on is there, because if one requires a limitation on damages, it only makes sense that the legislature would have required the verdict that is issued in a medical malpractice claim itemize those damages so you know what is non-economic and what is economic. It is in that context that I would read that statute. Succinctly stated, 655.007 is the grant of standing to bring a medical malpractice case. 893.55 is an enumeration of the type of damages one may collect once the right has been conferred in the first place. The last point I would make, because my time is nearly up, is simply that this whole idea of a separate common law claim for medical malpractice brings yet more difficulties. For example, it has long been the common law, it has long been the tradition in this state that there is no claim for contribution against a negligent physician by a tortfeasor. So someone's hurt in a car accident, a doctor compounds the injury by an act of malpractice, there is no contribution claim because they are not joint tortfeasors under the law. Does this proposal change that? And finally, if we read this in conjunction with Sapansky, do we now have the peculiar situation where we have a parent, an adult child, who cannot sue for the loss of society and companionship of his parent who dies from an act of malpractice, yet may sue for their negligent infliction of emotional distress while they were at the bedside watching the parent pass? It is these kinds of questions that I think make it difficult for the court to accept the plaintiff's position. And I see my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Burnett. Mr. Aiken, representing Joseph Finnegan.
Thank you, if you please, the court. I really want to start off by saying I have three essential points to make. One is, everyone, I think, is unfortunately focused upon the facts of the child's death instead of the facts as they were in existence before any resuscitation occurred. This is not to concede that one sentence in Bowen would control the facts after the resuscitation, because I think it's being taken out of context. But if we look at the facts of this case, as reported in Mrs. Finnegan's deposition, as reported in the appendix of Aurora at page 20021, the facts come to light as follows. One is, the Finnegans had taken Jared to the hospital, to the doctor, and had asked for a blood test. The blood test was done. Two, the Finnegans call up the clinic and say, what's with the blood test? And they're told, if there's anything wrong, the doctor will get back to you. Truth of the matter is that the treating pediatrician was not on call that night. His partner was. The partner got a call. The blood test showed sepsis, which means there's an infection in the blood. As I'm sure the court now knows, having read the case, sepsis oftentimes leads to meningitis because the sepsis in the blood moves into the spinal fluid, resulting either in meningitis or encephalitis, almost always causing death or severe disability. So now at 9 o'clock at night, the doctors knew or should have known this child needed immediate care. Mom even had called, and yet her note was put on the side of a desk. The next morning she calls and says, my baby is really bad. He's dehydrated, he's mottled,
He looks really sick. He's not looking at me. And by baby, I mean young Jared. She goes to the doctor's office a half an hour before her appointment and said, he's really bad. I need him to be seen. There then comes information to her through Dr. Multani and the nurse that actually the blood test had come back the night before and it had shown a bad result, and mom and dad had to get Jared to the hospital as quickly as possible. So now they know that, my goodness, the blood test I asked for, the test result I called about, it was bad. And instead of being at the hospital at 9:30 the night before, it's 9 o'clock the next day, and they're being told, get in the car and rush your baby over to the hospital. So if we have to know the incidents of what led to the injury, the parents have it right there. So then they, on the way to the hospital, little baby Jared stops breathing. Dad shakes him. Mom says, I always put my child in a car seat, but this time I thought I had to hold him. That's how fearful she was for his life. So they shake him, and he comes back, and he starts breathing. Then in the elevator on the way up, he stops breathing. Mom gets to the pediatric floor and yells, is this the pediatric floor? And she was a respiratory therapist years ago. She said, my baby has stopped breathing. The nurse takes the baby, lays the baby on the bed, and says, well, let's see. And Mom says again, my baby has stopped breathing. The nurse looks down and says, oh my goodness, get Dr. Multani, call a code blue. That child would never breathe on his own again. So before any resuscitation started, this parent had observed a serious injury that would eventually result first, and that day he was struck down but still lived true. Well, but only his body lived. And eventually his demise. So we are not emphasizing the fact that mom happened to hold the baby at the hospital as he took his, not his last breath because he was being fed his breath, but as they weaned him off of the machines. We're emphasizing what happened before that time. When she knew that the blood test was bad, when she knew she had to rush her baby to the hospital, when she felt her baby twice stop breathing in her arms, when she saw the baby lying on the bed completely mottled, and on the verge of death without a code blue. It's not the code blue. That's my first point. And I think you will see if you read the deposition, which is our pages 72 through about 77, which are, as I said, at 20.0021, you'll see that as I recited the facts, I am being accurate. The second point I wish to make is it is completely illogical to hold that Bowen claims are not secondary derivative. There's a difference between an injury being independent and saying that that means therefore or ipso facto that the claim is not secondary or dependent. It is first illogical to say it's not that it's not secondary, because to rule otherwise would be to say that a 99% at fault plaintiff, although that person's barred, that the relative who claims emotional distress would not be barred. That's illogical. It would also be illogical because it would expand the insurance policy limits under most automobile policies, and I think the court knows that in Gocha and other cases, the Court of Appeals has ruled, although it's independent, we're ruling it's one injury for purposes of insurance policies. It would be illogical for many other reasons, but the biggest is because everything that's said in Bowen makes it a secondary or derivative claim. The injury must be serious or it must be death. That's the plaintiff's injury. So that means that unless there's a serious injury or death, no matter what the parent or loved one suffers, it doesn't count. Also, the third element is that the injury or death or the immediate aftermath must be observed. So it doesn't matter how bad the parent or loved one has suffered. If she or he has not observed the incident or the aftermath, there's no claim. And lastly, it's dependent because there must be a relationship between the two people. It doesn't matter if I see my best friend struck by a car, lying in the street bleeding, about to die, known him for 50 years, doesn't cut the mustard. Has to be a close relative.
So there are many guarantees of trustworthiness. In fact, as Justice Wilcox pointed out in his concurring opinion Bowen, there can be other guarantees of trustworthiness, such as in this case, we have a nationally renowned psychologist who said that both Finnegan's, but in particular Mrs. Finnegan, suffers from post-traumatic stress syndrome. The old saw, at least you could say goodbye, is just that, an old saw. Psychologists will tell you, and this case will prove, that there is nothing worse than holding your loved one as that person has a serious injury like this. Thinking to yourself, should I have done more about that phone call the night before? Thinking, why didn't they bring me in the night before? Why didn't one doctor call the other? Why didn't the nurse call the doctor? Why did I listen to them when they said, if the results are bad, we'll get a hold of you? There could be nothing worse. That is a fate worse than death. I think many of us, not in our generation, but in the generation of my parents' age, many people lost their children. It was a much more common occurrence than it is today. And we all recognize that the death of a child is an occurrence that the statutes have prescribed a certain remedy for. But this is a different sort of event. This is an event that calls into play everything that we argued back in Bowen. Now, if the claim is not a, if Bowen is not a derivative secondary claim, then this court has, as defense counsel has noted, and the amicus briefs thoroughly, at least three instances where the court has allowed non-patients to bring independent claims. And for the defense to say, well, the legislature meant to bar those, well, on what constitutional ground do we just bar independent claims? That is also illogical, and the court, as it sure is well aware, you are duty-bound to interpret these statutes to be constitutional whenever possible. And this is, to me, a very easy statutory analysis. This is a derivative claim by every sense of the term. In our brief, we quote from Black's Law Dictionary, which clearly, in every definition that we listed there, this type of claim fits. And then the subject then that pops up is, does 893.55.4a and 5a allow this claim? And I think it's interesting that we see how the defense position has drifted more towards this isn't derivative and away from the fact that 4a and 5a do not allow it, because quite clearly 4a does control it. It defines non-economic damages as including mental distress, mental injury, and actually differentiates that from bodily injury. To say that because 5A doesn't repeat everything in 4A, when 4A defines the term used in 5A, is ridiculous statutory construction. So, we believe that the statutes clearly allowed it. Obviously, even the Court of Appeals now recognizes Zulikowski was not well decided, and I think that the defense by their actions has really decided that it's not well decided, which is why they're trying to get it out of 655. And I agree with their decision in that regard, because it's clearly part of 4A and 5A, and it would take a distorted reasoning to say that 5A must list every single item of damages when one of the items is defined as including mental distress. I should add, defense counsel has raised that what are we going to do with the verdict form? Well, that's what we have instructions for. There'll be an award for non-economic damages, and then we would instruct the jury on what that included. Just like pain, suffering, and disability is a verdict question, and there's a two-page instruction to the jury on what that means. Now, I want to address the issue of whether or not this will cause runaway claims. I think that my learned friends from the defense, who know me only too well in this business, know that we, I think, do more of this sort of work than anybody in this state. And I think this is the first one I've brought. This one's unusual. It's unusual that the patient would know the facts of the malpractice, so to speak, even as the events unfurl. That would be unusual. But indeed, that's what occurred here. They knew that the test results were not properly reported to the treating physician by both his partner and by the nurse. They knew that they had to rush Jared to the hospital 12 hours later than they should have rushed him to the hospital. They knew that this caused their child to be sicker all night long. They knew that their child stopped breathing not once but twice, and they knew that that would be the last time he would breathe on his own. So it's much different than your typical medical negligence claim, where it may be a year or two or three, and Lord knows the court knows my face here, arguing statute of limitation cases, it can be a half a decade before a patient figures out that they've been malpracticed upon. So this is different than the ordinary case. I would also submit that if this case is under 655, which I agree that it is, the damages are capped at $410,000 presently. In the real world of medical malpractice, you don't need to join a bunch of other people to build the damages up, because you either have a claim that's worth that or it isn't brought. So I don't think there'll be any runaway at the gates. Plus, this case is again different because rather than someone just saying, again, as noted both by the majority and the concurring opinion in Bowen, that we need guarantees of trustworthiness, this claim is supported by learned psychological authority and testing. So this isn't just someone saying, oh, I feel bad, or man, am I in distress, or I don't think it can work. This is a case where there was extensive testing and a report issued to support the claim.
Mr. Aiken?
Yes?
I'd like to bring you back to just about 30 seconds ago when we were talking about why this was a unique claim. Early in your argument, you indicated that the aftermath, and at least I thought what you were saying was that in order to recover for emotional distress, the aftermath must be observed. That's a direct quote from you. Well, it strikes me that the aftermath is always observed in every medical malpractice case, so there must be something else that makes this unique that I didn't quite catch.
Well, I didn't mean the long-term aftermath, because that's where I think that statement in Bowen that says of being in the hospital and seeing the person die or seeing the person worked out in the ambulance isn't enough. That's too much of a long-term aftermath. Even the hospital, even the ambulance ride is apparently too long, according to Bowen. Here, we have the parents observing the foremath, so to speak. Then the deterioration during the night, the further severe deterioration in the morning, learning of the malpractice, and then going on and seeing their child actually stop breathing for the last time. So it's these parents were not observing an aftermath. These parents were observing it as it unfolded. And it's the death may be the aftermath, that the ultimate holding the child in their arms as the child died may not be the compensable injury. And I don't think that that's what we intend to prove. The traumatic nature of this injury was the fact that they saw their child going downhill, believing up until around 9:30 in the morning that the test results were normal and this was a flu bug, and all of a sudden learning, oh my goodness, they weren't, get to the hospital, and then having their child not physically but mentally die in their arms. So mental was the injury that the child's automatic response to breathe was shut down. So this was not an aftermath observation. This was an unfolding observation. I agree in some cases that there may be malpractice no one even knows about, someone sees somebody die, but if the court was willing to draw a line at the ambulance trip, it isn't hard to draw. Negligent situation. But my point is, it just isn't here. Because before anybody knew that, the Finnegans knew their baby was hurt before the hospital people did. Because the nurse took the baby and put the baby on the bed without even doing anything at first. When Mrs. Finnegan, with her experience, says, my goodness, he's not breathing, call somebody. And finally the nurse said, oh yeah, well, let's get Dr. Multeni up here. And then everything unfolded quickly and promptly. That activity may be excluded, unless it's a continuum of events. But certainly in this case, we have the unfolding.
Mr. Aiken.
Yes.
This is, by anybody's definition, a tragic case. Seems somewhat absurd, frankly, to argue legal technicalities. Bowen, 655, That's what we do in the law. And let us just suppose that in this case, the parents did not know that there had been malpractice, did not know about the fact that the blood test had come back badly and that no one had told them for 12 hours. I'm going to try and isolate the facts that differ this case from other cases. So they don't know that. They just see a child going downhill rapidly and very severely and looking towards death. But they don't know it's malpractice. Is that going to fall within Bowen, in your opinion?
I think, as Bowen said, it's a case-by-case analysis.
Well, I
think your case is a close case, because if indeed they knew there was a blood test requested and indeed they had a reasonable founded suspicion that something must have been done wrong, because how did my baby get so sick so quick, I would say that would fall in Bowen. If they didn't have a clue, if they just then found out later, oh my goodness, you mean there was a blood test that was missed or an x-ray that was misread, then I think that it would be outside of the Bowen case. I don't think, see, because Sharon Bowen didn't know that the other driver was negligent when she came upon the scene, but she knew that there had been a bad accident. That's why I'm unwilling to say that the patient would have to know that there was malpractice, quote unquote, but they certainly should be aware that something was awry, that something was not correct, not that just somebody got sick. So that if someone, let's say a clearer case would be a CAT scan is misread in 1999, and in 2002 the patient's husband starts going downhill and dies from a cancer that could have been diagnosed, I think that's clearly outside the realm of Bowen. But if the patient's husband had said, geez, doc, what's that spot up on the CAT scan? Oh, don't worry about that. That's just an artery that's out of shape. Now I think you have a closer question. I think it goes case by case, but what was the well-grounded suspicions of the people as this thing unfolded? And that's where I think that, unfortunately, trial courts like black-letter rules to follow. But I think that both the majority opinion and the concurring opinion, Bowen said, no, this is a case-by-case analysis, and some cases are going to be close than others. And I do think that the trial bar needs some guidance on this in order to properly apply it to medical negligence, but I don't know why the court would want to allow the type of claims that were posited in Sawyer, Johnson, and, in fact, the Altenburg case, and not allow these claims, which are so much more verifiable and are so much more grounded in the reality of the unfolding of events. And I can see other cases that could be somewhat similar to this where the courts actually did allow recovery before Bowen. The Westcott case involved malpractice during delivery, and I can't remember enough of the facts of that case, but if we, for example, posited the Schreiber case, which was a case where the lady asked for a C-section, the doctor said no, and then the baby, all of a sudden she had her placenta released and the baby was born brain damaged. Now, I can see there that that's a Bowen claim. She could well have a Bowen claim because she asked for a C-section, the doctor said no, and then all of a sudden the proverbial manure hit the fan and she gets a brain damaged baby out of it. Baby could die, baby could live, wouldn't matter. Now, there I can see it being a Bowen claim. But there are certainly many circumstances where I see it would not be a Bowen claim.
One of my concerns is this no stopping point argument. And you, in this case, say this is rather unique. This is not the malpractice and then 10 years or 3 years or 5 years later finding the injury. It seems to me that most baby delivery malpractice cases, though, would fall within this, quote, unique sort of situation, thus becoming really less unique.
Oh, I don't agree. I'm sorry.
You talked about the Schreiber case. You talked about the Westcott case.
Westcott's a closer case if that should have ever been allowed. Schreiber, I think, is a clear-cut case. I think that the implicit in Bowen, both in majority opinion and concurring opinion, is that we need something more. And the something more is some reasonable ground or suspicion that something's been done wrong. Now, in your typical baby case, frankly, I probably review 10 of them a week, and I reject almost all 10. I mean, just because a baby comes out brain damaged doesn't mean there's been any malpractice. So I would think it would be unusual in the obstetrical case rather than usual, unless there's some precedent event where the family has said, you know, for example, here where they asked for a test result, or in Schreiber where they asked for a C-section, or where they expressed their concern to the doctor, or they said, can you please call the doctor, and then the doctor just flat doesn't come in. There has to be something in the unfolding of the events that allows the patient to know that something had gone, was going awry.
That's the phrase you use, going awry. If the baby were brought to me after delivery, brain damaged, I would say something has gone awry. Just like in the Bowen case, you make the point that she did not have to know that there was negligence, but she had to know something had gone awry, and she was there immediately after that something had gone awry. So why doesn't it pertain to most baby delivery cases?
I think my friends from the defense will support me on this. I think something like 70 to 80% of all brain damaged new babies are either causation is not known or it's known or it's identified as having occurred at least 48 to 72 hours before the birth. So the simple fact is that just because you have a baby that's either born blind, deaf, or brain damaged really shows nothing. Just because, that's why I said it had to be a reasonable suspicion that something had gone awry. Not, oh, my baby is born brain damaged. Plus, by the time the parents realize the baby's brain damaged, frankly, it's usually 18 months to 24 months, so it's going to be outside of Bowen in that circumstance. Somebody doesn't put a red bell on and say your child's been brain damaged. That's the very unusual brain damaged baby case. Usually they're resuscitated, and after about 48 or 72 hours, they start having some seizures, and then the thing unfolds, and very typically, it's 2 years before anybody says, oh, you know what, this child's never going to develop. So I think if you're concerned about obstetrical cases, you can put limitations on reasonable suspicions that something's going awry or had requested certain things and they weren't followed up upon. There's way to limit it without barring the claim, which is the same thing that I proposed in Bowen years ago, that it's better to put limitations on the manner of recovery than to just bar them on the basis of, well, we're afraid there'll be a landslide in these cases, when the truth of the matter is that just isn't so. It's just not going to develop that way, not at least the way I proposed it under this case. And remember, I had to take this case up when Zilikowski was still the established law of the state, and I just felt that this was a different case than the other cases that I had seen.
Well, just for, say, the sake of repeating yourself, give me the limitations very succinctly that you're saying that would be applicable.
I think that the where this case falls and where other case should fall is, number one is that the aftermath should be sharply defined. And it should be emphasized that it's preferred to see the unfolding versus the aftermath. Now, Sharon Bowen, the court said immediate aftermath. It was the immediate aftermath of the accident, but it was still very much unfolding. Her child, as you will remember, was trapped underneath the car, begging for breath, begging for mama's help. Mama stood helplessly by while no one could get the child extracted from the vehicle, wherein he ultimately suffocated because of that failure. So immediate aftermath in Bowen really is a narrow target. I think there should be a reasonable suspicion that something has gone awry. Meaning, I don't think that someone can say, as Justice Bradley asked, well, geez, I had a brain-damaged baby, so something must have gone awry, because that's not reasonable. And it can easily be disproved that that's not reasonable. Many, many children have cerebral palsy and other types of brain damage without anything having been done wrong by anybody. So in addition to the Bowen limitations, those are the two things that I think are reasonable prescriptions for this type of case, but I don't think it's reasonable then to take this other leap that, well, even though these people fulfill every Bowen criteria, including that they actually saw the unfolding, they saw more than Sharon Bowen did, as we point out in our brief. They experienced a lot more. And I'm drawing the line at resuscitation because I felt like there's too much argument about what Bowen meant by that. I don't think there's a type of resuscitation that occurred here is the type referred to in Bowen. Because Bowen, they're talking about if you get there and they're trying to revive the person in the ambulance, it's too late. Here, we were there before the resuscitation and it continued. So that I don't think this type of resuscitation is meant to be excluded, but only because we were already there. Just like I think that if Sharon Bowen came and they were able to get her child out from under the car and she rode in the ambulance, that those events would be excluded, but only because she was already there. Did I answer the question?
Yes, thank you.
I wanted to point out just a couple other things, and then I'm going to sit down. One is that the defense relied in their reply brief on a case by the name of Kazi Uradotsky. I can't say the name, but it's a Court of Appeals case cited in the defense brief. And they say there the Court of Appeals found that Bowen was independent, not derivative. And in fact, the Court of Appeals didn't find that. The Court of Appeals went one step worse. Court of Appeals said at page 10, in Bowen, our Supreme Court held that emotional distress claims are independent, comma, not derivative. I've read Bowen four times in the last 24 hours, and I cannot find anywhere where this court said that these are not derivative claims. Indeed, they said, you said it was an independent injury. You never said it was not a derivative claim. And I think that... I don't think we'd all be arguing about whether or not it's derivative, secondary, dependent, all those words mean the same thing as derivative. If indeed Bowen had addressed that, you can bet that it would have been quoted numerous times, but I decided to read the case a number of times just to make sure, and that is not in there. And I think clearly the criteria laid out in Bowen make it absolutely clear that it is a dependent claim for the reasons I stated before. Lastly, and this is just some things that were raised by my client, so I'm going to cover it to save time. The summary of the case, as reported in some of the literature, is inaccurate. The child did not die of meningitis the next day, and also the positive for bacteria was in the blood culture, not in the spinal tap. Now, I believe the spinal tap showed a problem, but that was not the act that we're complaining of. Once they knew of the blood result, they did the lumbar puncture as soon as they could resuscitate the baby. But so it's the blood culture that we maintain, and I believe I could be mistaken, but my memory is this case reached the court on a stipulated liability that they agreed that, by no surprise, that there had been a screw-up at the clinic, both in the communication by the partner and the communication by the nurse. If there are any other questions, I think I'm done.
Yeah, you indicated earlier there were certain economic caps to recovery.
Non-economic caps, yes. That's in the statute, it reads 350, but it's increased by the CPI, so it's now at 410, mm-hmm. And it covers all non-economic claims under 655.
I'm just interested, I guess this doesn't have a whole lot of to do with the case, but why are you not challenging the cap?
I don't have a verdict above 410 yet. I sure hope to get here and do that, but it was rejected on a 3-3 about 3-4 years ago in another case, but I hope to get my chance someday.
Thank you, Mr. Aiken. Mr. Arnold?
Thank you. To the extent that we have injected into this case, in our briefing, the issue of a Bowen claim being dependent on the plaintiff's knowledge of the cause of the gruesome scene that he or she encounters. I apologize for that and disavow it. There is nothing in Bowen to suggest that the plaintiff's knowledge of potential malpractice or potential negligence causing what the person witnesses is an element of that claim. Bowen makes very clear that the nature of the claim and what's compensated for is the plaintiff's visual perception of an event, and that knowledge gained from other sources, through hearing about it, through being told what happened, doesn't constitute a basis for a Bowen claim. There is absolutely nothing in Bowen to suggest that knowledge that the physician might have been negligent, or knowledge that the driver in Bowen might have been negligent, is a part of the claim. What is compensated for is what is the sensory experience that the plaintiff saw with her eyes.
And why is that not present here with the plaintiff, the mother and the father observing the condition of the baby and its deteriorating condition?
The plaintiffs observe the event, but not in the immediate aftermath, such that it's like they were there. There isn't a direct injury-producing event in this case, or in any negligent failure to diagnose case, as there is in an auto accident case like Bowen. There isn't anything to see when the phone call isn't responded to properly in the middle of the night. There's no event to observe. What the parents see is the natural progression of a disease that the patient had before the negligence occurred and continued to have after the negligence occurred.
But unlike many malpractice cases in which you don't really see that until, as was pointed out, you know, for a year, 2 years, this was, depending on the word you want to use, you know, very immediate, very in very close proximity to the act of malpractice, within hours. They saw the result of that malpractice.
But again, where is the logical stopping point? Suppose that this had been a more slowly progressing infection, and the symptoms hadn't developed for another 3 days, 4 days, 5 days. Where do we stop? There is no logical stopping point.
Okay, so you heard opposing counsel talk about how they would distinguish or what the stopping point. You disagree with that?
I do. I find nothing in Bowen to suggest that knowledge obtained from other sources about whether the what happened might be the result of medical negligence has any place in a Bowen claim. A Bowen claim is based on sensory perception and not on what you hear from something else. That's a clear distinction that Bowen insists on. I would like also to respond quickly to the statutory argument, which I didn't get a chance to address in my first argument. The plaintiff asserts that Bowen claims are implicitly recognized in 893.55 because mental distress and non-economic damages are defined there. I want to point out that 893.55 and the definitions contained there were adopted by the legislature at a time when the criteria adopted by the common law for a negligent infliction claim required zone of danger, physical injury, so that there was no reason on earth that the legislature, when it adopted that language, would have been contemplating the possibility of a bystander claim for negligent infliction of emotional distress in the medical malpractice context. In fact, all of the language, almost verbatim, that is in 893.55 sub 4 is found in the jury instruction describing pain and suffering of a plaintiff. The language is disfigurement and such impairment of mental and bodily health, physical abilities, bodily functions, and then humiliation, embarrassment, worry, and mental distress. That language comes out of the jury instruction on pain and suffering, and it was adopted by this court or recognized by this court and quoted by this court in 1983, long before the concept of a Bowen claim of this type in medical malpractice would have ever been thought of. That's Westfall versus Kotke, 110 West 2nd at 86.
Thank you, Mr. Arnold. Thank you, Mr. Aiken. And thank you, Mr. Burnett, who are the arguments this morning.